Hi, I'm Serial.
And I'm Umberto.
And we're the hosts of So You Think You Can Rule Persia, a podcast where we rate and review all the kings of Persia from Diocles to Yazdegerd III.
Join us for a look at the rulers of Iran, from the Achaemenids all the way to the Sassanids, with plenty in between.
We'll be discussing the lives and myths of the rulers of Persia before ranking them all and deciding who is really worthy of the title of King of Kings.
We hope to have you along for the ride.
Hello and welcome to Pontifex. I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree, ranking all of the popes from Peter to Francis. And this is episode 129, Pope Stephen VIII. Or in some sources, due to the confusion over Pope Stephen Elect, as we've seen before, Stephen the Ninth.
Yes, Stephen Elect. A papal bull, worthy man.
We did not give him a papal bull. You were so mad.
I know.
But this is Stephen the Eighth, the actual Eighth. Are you ready to get into him after last week's nothing pope?
Yeah, sure. Is this also a nothing pope?
Surprisingly, he is not a nothing pope. So let's get into it. Stephen was born in Rome somewhere around the year 900, potentially to some minor nobility, but unrelated to the House of Tusculum. Now, one account from our old Pope Joan source, Martinus Polonus, suggests that Stephen might have come from a family of German heritage with connections to the new king of East Francia, Otto. Remember the otters?
Yes, the otters.
Yes. So there may be a chance that he's related to them, but there's no other source other than Martinus Polonus that makes this claim. At some point, Stephen entered the church, and we don't know anything else about his church career until April of 938, when he was made the cardinal priest of Santi Silvestre e Martino I Monti by Pope Leo VII. He was cardinal priest for a bit over a year until Pope Leo VII died, and then Stephen was chosen to be the next puppet pope of Alberic, the patrician of Rome. Again, we have no concrete evidence as to why he was the one chosen, unless we take Martinus Polonus's suggestion that Stephen's Germanic relative Otto imposed his will and chose a new pope. But that's a bit premature at this point. Otto will definitely be featuring more in our show and will be fighting to impose his will all over the papacy.
As a tiny otter.
As a tiny otter, yes. He's going to be ottering all over this scene, but not quite yet. Stephen is still absolutely under the control of Alberic in Rome, first and foremost, and we have no reason to think that Otto is trying to poke his way in quite yet.
What's Otto's full name?
Otto?
Otto the what?
Otto the Great?
Otto the Great. Otto One.
Otto the First, yes. Otto the First, son of Henry the Fowler and Matilda. But, unlike the last two puppet popes of Alberic, we're actually going to see Stephen exist on the political world stage with an actual voice and some verifiable action. It's not a nothing pope.
Okay.
And this is mainly thanks to what else but instability in the Frankish kingdoms? And this is going to get a little complicated, so we're going to try and be as succinct as possible to not get bogged down with too many details. So just remember, as you're listening, that this is just a summary. And for more details about the Frankish conflicts, Battle Royale is going to have you covered. And I say this with full confidence because they've already surpassed us in the timeline. So what we're dealing with at this moment is the complicated kingship of King Louis IV, King of West Francia. Louis IV, also known as King Louis d'Outremer, or from overseas, was the son of Charles the Simple, who we last discussed in John the 11th episode, episode 127, because he'd been taken prisoner and deposed as King of West Francia, by Count Herbert of Vermandois. And because he's going to be a central figure in this conflict, let's also not forget that Count Herbert of Vermandois is the count who made his 5-year-old son Hugh the Archbishop of Reims. Baby bishop. Do you remember that? Is that coming back to you?
The baby bishop.
Okay. Baby bishop. Anyways, when Charles the Simple had been deposed, he was replaced with King Robert, and then his son-in-law, King Rudolph. But when Rudolph died in 936, it was assumed that the actual son of King Robert and Rudolph's brother-in-law, Hugh the Great, Duke of the Franks, would take the crown. But Robert did not want to sit on the throne and preferred to rule behind a puppet. After all, this is the century. That's all about that. They love a puppet ruler. So Robert and Herbert of Vermandois, as the most powerful nobles in West Francia, come together and decide to invite the deposed Charles the Simple's son, Louis, to become king. And at this time that he was recalled, Louis was actually in Wessex, England, in the court of King Athelstan, who was his uncle. This is why he is called Louis from overseas, and makes an excellent Rex Factor connection. So Louis comes back to West Francia and assumes the title of king, as he was invited to do. But after some time as a puppet to Duke Hugh, he starts actually acting like a king in his own right. It's like, hey, I'm king. You've told me what to do. I've gotten myself started. Maybe I'll just take the reins here and be king. But neither Hugh nor Herbert actually wanted Louis to be anything other than their mouthpiece. So Louis attending to be an independent ruler was not at all in line with their goals. Quoting Horace K. Mann, he had been offered the crown because it had been fondly imagined that he would not attempt to wear it effectively. But when it was found that Louis wished to be king in reality as well as in name, several of the more powerful nobles, chief among them were Hugh the Great, Duke of the Franks, whose authority extended over the territory between the Loire and the Seine, and Herbert of Vermandois, combined against him. So, as this suggests, Herbert and Hugh now rose up in rebellion against Louis, since they were the powerful nobles with all the influence and connections, and so they're already off to a significant head start. They even appealed to the new king of East Francia, Otto, to back them up. So they called out to the little otter.
They did.
Imagine him getting a letter. Come join us.
God, it's like a Brian Jacques novel.
But as the rebellion gets underway, Pope Stephen finds out about it and immediately gets involved. He can't have this ongoing instability, particularly if he has any notions of becoming more than a puppet pope himself, or getting out of Alberic's grasp in Rome. Now, whether or not this was his actual consideration in getting involved is purely speculation. We don't know if he had any personal motivation of independence at this point, but it would definitely make sense. It might be why he would sympathize with Louis, but also, if you're a pope and you want to have an ally, let's say, against someone like Alberic, who thinks he's in control of the popes, you need your ally to be a leader who has his nobles behind him. If you're going to make a move, you can't have your big supporter be in chaos.
True.
So he sends a new legate to the West Frankish nobles and instructed them very clearly to recognize Louis as king and to fall in line.
Bend the knee.
Bend the knee, yes. And while this command didn't quite convince the ambitious Hugh or Herbert, what it did do was convince the Frankish bishops that had been supporting Hugh and Herbert to pull back and consider their loyalty. Flodard tells us that the bishops in Reims actually held a synod where they called on Count Herbert to end his rebellion and to convince Hugh to do the same. Quote, Damasus, the legate of Pope Stephen VIII, was ordained bishop at Rome for the purpose of fulfilling this mission and came to Francia carrying a letter of the Apostolic See to the princeps of the kingdom and to all the inhabitants of Francia and Burgundy so that they might receive Louis as their king. However, if they should fail to do this and continue to attack him with a hostile sword, the Pope would excommunicate them.
With a hostile sword.
Hostile swords, yes. Therefore, the bishops of the province of Reims spoke with Count Herbert of Vermandois and begged him to intercede with the princeps Hugh to accept the king. So this is a relatively significant result. Because remember, so much of Frankish power is wrapped up in the concept of moral legitimacy. So if the bishops are not in support of an action, it's going to lose a great deal of its momentum. So this was, in effect, a partial victory for the Pope. Hey, maybe I didn't get Hugh and Herbert to do exactly what I want, but I've got the bishops on side. But he's not satisfied with just a partial victory anyways, and concluded that the best way to end the rebellion was to be sneaky and to compromise Hugh and Herbert's alliance with one another.
Oh, playing the two sides against each other.
Exactly. And like the Frankish bishops, the Pope determined that Herbert would likely be the most accessible candidate to pressure into change. So he writes to Herbert and offered a pallium to his son, the young Hugh, Archbishop of Reims. Now, you might remember with this whole baby bishop situation that in Pope John the 11th's episode, we mentioned that the child bishop had been deposed.
Yeah.
And he had.
He wasn't a baby bishop anymore.
Yeah, they had kicked out the baby bishop. But we also mentioned that the people of Reims had been very uncomfortable recognizing their new bishop, Artold, because Hugh, the kicked out baby bishop, was still alive. So they're like, this is not how this is supposed to go. And so, when Hugh and Herbert had consolidated their alliance, they had forced out that new bishop, Artold, in favor of Herbert's son once more. So, the Pope is now offering to reward this way too young bishop who's not supposed to be there and has been put in by political force with a pallium. So this would be a massive declaration of legitimization should he be challenged on the grounds of having been too young, having been illegitimately appointed to the role, and having been deposed in the past. Having a pallium from the Pope is going to make all of that kind of go away. And perhaps Herbert was tempted by this. But he wasn't tempted enough to abandon his alliance with Hugh or his refusal to submit to Louis. Until the Pope followed up his order with another legate who brought news to all of the nobles and all of the bishops of West Francia, making it crystal clear that any cleric or noble who he had not received confirmation of obedience to King Louis by Christmas would be excommunicated. Like, full-on threats of excommunication. We have not seen this in a very long time. Quoting from Floatert again, the legates of the Church of Reims returned to Rome, bringing back with them from Pope Stephen the pallium for Archbishop Hugh. They also went to the princeps of the kingdom, so they might receive Louis as king and send their own legates to Rome. But if this were not done by the nativity of the Lord, they understood that they would then be excommunicated. And it worked. Many important Frankish nobles who had withheld support from Louis now declared their obedience openly, which shifted the tide against Hugh and Herbert. And by that Christmas deadline, with some additional peace negotiations pursued by King Otto, all of the nobles of West Francia, including Hugh and Herbert, had declared their obedience to King Louis.
Oh.
So all told, this is a big win for Pope Stephen.
They did bend the knee.
They did the thing. And the Pope has actually had a voice. But while he'd had some relative success with the Franks, things are, once again, very unstable in Rome. The peace and marriage alliance that had been forged between Alberic and King Hugh of Italy by Odo, the abbot of Cluny, in our last episode, began to fall apart already. And Hugh showed up at the gates of Rome. Again.
Ah, oh, jeez.
And to be clear, this is a different Hugh from the Frankish Hugh. This is the King of Italy Hugh.
There's so many Hughes right now.
So many Hughes. This is the era of Hughes. But just like last time that this had happened, the Pope doesn't attempt to mitigate this conflict himself and calls back Odo from Cluny to crack some skulls together and compel both Hugh and Alberic to go back to observing the terms of their peace. Which he does seem to have accomplished, according to Floatard. You know, when things go wrong, just call back for the guy. He's still around. Now, if things had ended there, this might have been a moment of success and stability, and maybe we would have been giving Stephen a little bit of credit for this. However, what happened at this point flipped everything on its head. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Can you guess what might throw all of this out of balance?
A plague.
Well, that would be a good guess, but it's a little bit more direct than that.
Okay.
You see, someone tried to assassinate Alberic.
Oh, okay.
And it failed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So whoever actually headed the conspiracy is totally unclear, particularly because depending on what source you look at, everyone is suspected in having a role to play. It could have been King Hugh of Italy shooting his shot to end the feud once and for all. It could have been the nobles of Rome, fed up with the constant sieging and Alberic's total control. According to chronicler Benedict of Soracte, it was Alberic's sisters who plotted against him. But one sister lost her nerve and informed her brother of the plot, ensuring it failed.
Oh.
And more importantly for us, there are some sources, including Martinus Polonus, who claims that the Pope was at the heart of the scheme and plotted with several bishops to kill Alberic and retake some semblance of control for the papacy.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so it could have been all of these suggestions, it could have been some in any combination. All we know is that someone tried to kill Alberic and shot their shot and missed. So, that's gonna throw it all into chaos. And regardless of who was responsible, the unfortunate and important reality is that the plan failed, and if Alberic had been overbearing before, he now went full tilt, balls to the wall, brutal and paranoid. He had any caught conspirators scourged and beheaded and viciously cracked down on any dissent or criticism against him at any level of nobility. And unfortunately, this went really, really badly for poor Pope Stephen, whether he was involved in the assassination attempt or not, because Alberic, or his supporters, apprehended the Pope, tortured, and maimed him. They apparently mutilated the Pope so badly, according to various sources like Bartolomeo Platina, that he never appeared in public again.
Oh.
Yeah.
Too embarrassed.
Or, like, so horrifically disfigured that he couldn't show his face or even wasn't physically capable of it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, given everything that happened to Pope Stephen, we have to wonder if he wasn't appearing because of his wounds or if he'd just actually been imprisoned, right? It may just be that they threw him in a dungeon, like Pope John XI had been.
Yeah.
Also, it should be said that this account of the Pope being brutalized by Alberic or his followers is most often cited from Martinus Polonus, but Polonus's account has been largely discredited, particularly as he claims this act of violence had to do with Alberic's supporters hating Pope Stephen for being German and being imposed on them because of Otto the Great, which we've already pointed out is definitely not the case. So more likely it was tied to whatever was going on with this assassination attempt, if it happened at all.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So there's that to consider as well.
This, big sighs from me.
It's not a good time. Yeah. And if mutilating the Pope didn't quite make the point that Alberic was still in charge of all of Rome, including the church, Alberic then decided to convene a synod in Rome on August 17th, 942, where he instructed, commanded, and appointed various important church officials, including roles we've discussed before of the primusarius, secundarius, and vestiarius.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. He's like, I'm going to disfigure the Pope, and now I'm in charge.
Yeah, if you forgot I was in charge, here I am. I'm going to appoint all of these roles, and you better not say anything against it, or I'll do the same to you.
Yeah.
So, not much actually comes out of this synod other than Alberic waving his influence around, but it firmly kicks any hopes Stephen had of independence right back into puppet territory.
This man's a bad guy. Does he know he's the bad guy?
Does he know he's the bad? I mean, no. He definitely was like, I am ridding this city of the tyranny of my mother and her terrible lusty choices, and now he's mutilating the Pope. So,
yeah, like he's taking it some steps too far here.
Yeah, exactly. But it was also around this time that Pope Stephen died.
From being mutilated?
Yeah, exactly. It's also, there is some speculation that he died during the initial attack against him, and we don't know that for sure. And because we don't know that for sure, I'm going to read you the most dramatic version of Pope Stephen's death that exists. And this is from a book called Unzipped, The Pope's Bear All by Arthur Frederick Ide. And I have to say before I read this, this book is by no means a reliable source, but it's a very, very fun and dramatic one that I always check for scandal stuff. So this is that recollection of Stephen's death. Quote, desiring to purge iniquities out of Rome, Stephen VIII conspired against Alberic, cajoling various young priests to murder the prince. Being discovered duplicitous in this manner, Stephen was arrested and imprisoned. When one of the nuns of Stephen's household attempted to seduce and kill Alberic while in the act of making love, Alberic's hatred for the old man boiled beyond control. Arresting the Pope, Alberic had Stephen stripped naked. With the nude pontiff groveling before him, Alberic developed unique devices that brutalized the sagging papal flesh.
What?
While, quote-unquote, injuring his spirit.
Okay, there's so much happening here.
Oh yeah, and it's not done. You ready?
Oh god, okay.
Legends have it that the prince employed biting fish and prostitutes to cut open the pontiff's skin.
Biting prostitutes?
Biting prostitutes. Into the tears, the prince poured salt and lye, and Stephen died from his injuries, being taunted with the cup of poison. The poison he had hoped to have given Alberic held beckoningly just beyond his grasp. So, yeah, all of that.
Okay.
I guess the Pope was trying to get young priests to murder him, but also to get a nun to kill him during the act of lovemaking, but also was planning to poison him with a cup that then was turned against him during the biting fish and prostitutes and sagging papal flesh brutalism.
Biting fish and biting prostitutes.
biting fish and prostitutes to cut employed biting fish and prostitutes.
They paid the fish too.
How much did he have to pay the fish?
The prostitutes expected to get paid, but the fish, they got a bonus.
So you can see why this book is not necessarily a reliable source. But yeah, there's some gold in there. So anyways, Pope Stephen VIII was buried in Old St. Peter's. Tomb destroyed for New St. Peter's. And no epitaph survives.
Who buried him? It doesn't sound like anyone would bury him.
Maybe the next pope would take care of that. It's sort of the thing you do. The next pope, from my recollection, is not a bad guy. An ineffectual guy, but, you know. You would do the thing once you get elected. Once you get appointed at this point, really. But yeah, that's Pope Stephen VIII. Kind of a switch from last week, eh?
Yeah, that was
This is going to be an unexpected one, for sure.
With how fast, like, Alberic got angry, I almost thought that he got mad mid-coitus.
Well, I mean, he did. When one of the nuns of Stephen's household attempted to seduce and kill Alberic while in the act of making love, Alberic's hatred for the old man boiled beyond control. It did
That is what happened. That I understood that.
You know, don't you ever just in the middle of sex think, oh, I just hate him so much.
I just hate that old man so much.
Yeah. That's a normal reaction. Yeah.
Oh, obsession much. Right.
Very much so. So, are you ready to rate this man?
Okay, sure. Papatum and Phallium.
So there's actually things here to rate in Papatum and Phallium. Let's start with his intervention in West Francia. Horace K. Mann argues that Stephen's intervention and threat to the Frankish nobles absolutely was the most important factor in bringing the nobles to heel. So there is that to consider. He is actually using the threat of excommunication and the pressure of the Frankish bishops very effectively here, which we have not seen a pope do in a long time.
Okay.
We might also want to consider that he might have been attempting to get free from Alberic's influence and regain a semblance of independence, but that's a lot more speculative.
No, he can't do that. Alberic's just going to think so hard about him all day long.
Yep, especially while lovemaking with nuns. Hey, we've hit sex with nuns!
Oh, this is not the one I expected. I expected that saucy painting.
Oh, we will get to the saucy painting, don't you worry.
You know the one I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely. So, what do we want to give him?
I think I can give him, maybe a 5 for trying.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I'm going to go quite as high as a 5, but it's still really impressive. So, I was kind of hanging around a 3 or a 4. Maybe I'll give him a 3. Because I think an 8 is a nice number for the effort he managed to wield when everything else was such awful chaos.
Yeah, he tried.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good trier.
He's a good trier.
God, we haven't said that in a while.
We certainly haven't.
Fructus prohibitum.
So he might have been involved in the assassination plot. And particularly some sources suggest that bishops might have been involved. And then we have this horrible account of him trying to get nuns to seduce him and poison cups. It's
possible. This wily coyote trying to kill Alberic thing is not selling me.
I know, I am not compelled by it either. I will say, of all the popes of this era that are very, very puppet pope to the House of Tusculum, he's the most likely. If there was going to be one who was going to fight for his own independence or make a move, I would believe it of him, but I still think he's innocent.
All right, so, can we give him a token one?
Yeah, he'll get the token one for sure.
Secularii impactum.
Well, everything that we've talked about that would count for this category, we've already talked about in Impapetum and Valium. He ensured the success of Louis IV's kingship, but this was primarily through the exercise of papal primacy and papal authority. We could, on a broad view, say that he helped the limping Carolingian dynasties last a tad longer, if that's worth anything.
Maybe another token one here.
Yeah, token one seems fair. He did some things, and we haven't seen things in a while. A one.
Fossium Sanctus.
Okay, so this is going to be an interesting category because I have three images for you, and they're three entirely different men. So first, we're definitely going to spend some time on them because the one we're going to rate him on, the St. Paul's Outside the Walls portrait, is such a heavy profile. So this is that man.
It looks like he's snubbing his nose. Who's he even looking at?
Yeah, maybe he's hiding all of the wounds.
The wounds. He kind of looks like he has a wound on his cheek.
Yeah, that is not a healthy looking cheek. It's even shaded red.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what the other side of the face looks like then, so... It does have sort of a grumpy look about it, but look, if I had been mutilated and brutalized, I also would probably not want to look at the camera.
The painter.
The painter, yes, but, you know. So, how do you feel about it otherwise?
You know what? Very rarely do we get a pope that's outside of the normal three-quarter view.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to give him a six.
Okay, yeah, this is... I don't hate it at all. Like, he's got very pronounced features. There's a very readable expression. He's got some very wavy hair going on. The beard is very neat. I think I will match your six because I kind of like it, which gives him a 12. When divided out, he'll get a 3 for Fatium Sanctus. Now, let's look at two entirely different men.
Okay.
There's the first one by the bad artist.
Huh.
That's not at all the same guy. That is a man with drag brows.
And, like, a mustache that doesn't connect to his beard.
Yeah, and it's a very tiny mustache. Like, it's bushy.
The tiniest mustache. And then it's like he sort of shaved his beard down just to, you know, a little bit of beard.
Yeah, that, like, just past 5 o'clock shadow, but full kind of look.
Yeah.
It's different. All right, and now here is a third entirely different man.
Oh, that is...
With some hella cheekbones.
Maybe that wound, the gaping wound on the side of his face, they tried to replicate that.
Oh, you think that they've just sort of been generous with it and made it a cheekbone?
Yes.
Because it's definitely not a cheekbone in the first one.
Mm-mm.
This one's nicer and sort of happier looking than the other two, but it's still not great.
He's got a weird tiny cherub mouth, though.
He does. It's very tiny. He looks much more at peace with everything that's going on around him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll give him his 3.
Tempus Pontificus.
July 14th, 939 to October 942. 3 years and a score of 0.75.
All right, everybody, it's the canon bonus round!
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. None of these pornocracy boys are gonna get it.
No. I mean, we're in an era where there's going to be a significant spell of no saints. It's funny, considering that this medieval period is potentially one of the largest times in terms of the church's dedication to saint worship and saint activity, that not a lot of popes are made saints. But anyways, that brings us to his total score, which, considering his era, is potentially impressive. He got a 13.75.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So in the run leading up to him, we've had a 2.75, an 11.5, an 11.75, 4.125, and now 13.75. So he's the first in a while that's had a good run. The last high scorer definitely did it on the back of Scandal, so it's not bad. And we'll have to consider that when I ask you, Fry, if you think he's papally enough, pizzazzy enough, with an impact enough for a papal bull?
I'm sorry, no.
Yeah, no. He is certainly more interesting than our last stretch of popes.
Yeah, than some popes for a while, but...
Yeah, he definitely has... Since our warrior pope... This is the first one who we've gone, oh, wow, there's absolutely something to talk about here. And while that's cool, it's just not enough. He would not hack it in the later rounds with some of our incredible papal bull scoring popes.
It's true.
So that brings us to the end of our episode, but we have some thank yous to make. First off, I would like to thank Dr. Rutger Kramer and Ethan and Roberto for helping with sources for this episode. And we have a patron to absolve of their temporal punishments. So thank you to Stephen Montseroff.
Ego te absolvo.
And that brings us to the full end of our episode. So thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Stay for otters.
Stay for otters.
Stay for the otters.
Oh my God, they're so cute.
Pontifax is edited by Greg Gassman. Greg is the host of the fabulous papal history podcast, Popular History, where you can also find cardinal numbers, ranking the cardinals of the Catholic Church, and coming up soon, Habemus Pointsum, where Greg and I will discuss all of the papal transitions that he loves so much. If you need to reach Greg, you can do so at popularhistory@gmail.com. Get it? It's like popular, but with an E for the popes.
If you would like to get in touch with us, you can reach us at pontifexpod@gmail.com, and we're pontifexpod on all social media platforms. If you'd like to support the show, consider subscribing to Pontifex on Patreon, checking out our research wishlist at tinyurl.com/pontifexwishlist, or making a one-time donation at paypal.me/pontifexpodcast. If you'd like to support us in other ways, rating and reviewing the show on iTunes makes a world of difference. I'm sorry. Hang on. Oh, hang on.
What's happening?
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Did it die again?
No.
Otter Pops! It's little Otto! He's an otter! Oh my gosh, we're gonna get so much use out of these otter Ottos very soon. And I love them. That's amazing. This little one with his hands up at his chest, like, this is magnificence.
I love him.
And you're going to be so happy to learn that there's at least 3 Ottos that we get to deal with. So we've got 1, 2, 3, and a crown.
Amazing.
It's perfect.